Hello and welcome to another episode of Your Average Critics, joined as usual by Chris and Obi. How are you both? Chris is on mute and I can't hear what you're saying, Obi, so I'm assuming that you're both... What a start. What a start. I'm assuming that you're both well. No news is good news. So we've got a few new releases to talk about today. or new releases for the UK anyway, considering one of the new releases I want to talk about came out 2 years ago in America. But have we all seen Ant-Man and the Wasp? Shall we start there?
We have.
Okay. So, the third Ant-Man film. Spoilers are going to ensue, as usual. It's post Endgame. It's the start of Phase 5. What we've got is Scott Lang. You see this from the trailer. He's kind of cashing in on his celebrity. Echo. Okay.
Chris, can you put yourself on mute, please?
Sure.
I can hear myself through your speaker. Well, through your microphone. So Scott Lang is cashing in on his celebrity, thanks to having helped save the world. He's written a book and basically trying to rebuild his relationship with Cassie, his daughter. And she's being a bit rebellious. She's going to jail for like peaceful protesting. And she's also been working in secret with her. She calls him grandfather. I can't remember what his actual relationship to them was, but Hank Pym. So they've been exploring the quantum realm, well, learning about the quantum realm, much to Scott and Janet Van Dyne's worry. Cassie also says to him, "Oh, you haven't really done anything since you saved the world," which, you know, I think's a tad harsh, considering I would rest on those laurels for the rest of my life. But anyway, they had to try and create some drama somehow. So Cassie's been fucking about with the quantum realm, and when you fuck about, you find out. And a signal that she sent down to quantum realm was received, and they are all pulled into the quantum realm and somehow managed to land not that far away from each other. and then essentially you got Scott and Cassie, and then Hope, Janet and Hank, and they're trying to find each other whilst we learn a little bit more about the people or the creatures in the quantum realm and the backstory of Janet Van Dyne in the 30 years she spent in the quantum realm. So there's those two parallel stories and then they converge towards the end. The Scott and Cassie bit to me felt very prequel Star Wars. And I don't say that as a compliment. But you know, there's some fun characters like the gloopy ooze thing. And then Hank, Janet and Hope. again, they go to some sort of cantina, Star Wars cantina, and then Janet reveals that she basically bumped into Kang when he first entered the quantum realm and helped rebuild his space chair energy source, which would help him get out of the quantum realm. But when she touched it, she saw all the atrocities that he'd committed, and then threw a Pym particle on it and made it so small, I think. I can't really remember what the size... Was it really small or really big? Because at some point...
I think it was really small.
Okay, really small. Thank you. And so she made him stuck there, essentially. And then he conquers the quantum realm and is essentially an evil dictator. We also get MODOK, who is Darren from the first Ant-Man film. Well, just his head. And he's a ridiculously shit character. In my opinion, the visual effects for his face are awful. And it was so much on camera. And then eventually, Kang captures Cassie and Scott, uses Cassie as leverage to say to Scott, you need to go, your thievery powers will help you steal back my energy core. Didn't really require much stealing powers. He immediately finds it, and then just has to navigate the paradoxical energy source or whatever it was where. Yes, Obi.
Can you remind me, did Ant-Man have to get really, really small to try and get that thing? Is that why he needed it?
Yeah, although Kang originally says...
Yeah, he had to get smaller like 5 times.
Right.
Yeah. Smaller and smaller and smaller.
But am I right in saying that originally Kang said, I need your skills as a thief?
He did say that, yeah.
I didn't catch that part.
Which it would have made more sense if Kang said, I need your skills at getting really small. Which I guess, you know, neither here nor there. But yeah, I mean, very quickly and relatively easily finds the core, which he gives back to Kang. But then at that time, he meets up with the rest of them and they're like, no, don't give it to him. And so he doesn't. And then a fight ensues. And then Kang, the almighty conqueror who has traversed time and space, killed Avengers several times over, conquered the quantum realm, is overrun by a colony of ants. The end. Obi, tell us your thoughts.
Can you guys hear me okay? Sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. So I don't hate it. I don't particularly like it either. I think the film itself feels quite weird. In the fact that, again, you actually mentioned it, it doesn't particularly feel like an MCU film, which is not necessarily a bad thing, but it feels like a Star Wars film, kind of, but also kind of like a hard sci-fi film, but not a good one. The story itself is fairly straightforward, I would say. They go to the quantum realm, Kang needs this, they don't give him that, he gets angry. They win the end. For a film called Quantumania, I think I expected maybe a bit more wackiness, I guess. Mm. And I suppose we did kind of get that in this form of some of like the ooze and like the buildings being alive and stuff like that, which was cool. And I suppose Ant-Man and the whole what was it called? That stuff, which is cool visually, that was cool. Felt like, kind of like Doctor Strange like, which is cool.
Sorry, can I just very quickly interject?
Yeah,
like,
go on.
You're talking about the mania and lack of. Like, I feel, you know, when the Multiverse of Madness, we got those short glimpses of the different universes they were traveling through. Mm. I think they missed an opportunity there in Ant-Man.
I guess, but they did do it. Like, where Janet, Hank, and. Oh, what's their face? They landed in like some large, field of plants, and then you see the like desolate homeland of these people, and then you see as they're going through the different zones, some sort of different differences. But I get what you mean. Doctor Strange did it more evidently than the Quantum Realm did it.
I think what Glenn's more pointing to is that is the mania part of it. So you're expecting. Something I think visually a bit more manic,
yeah, or, I suppose. Or
like different, like loads of different shit. Like you go to, like when, like you say, Doctor Strange, they all went to like different worlds to do any sort of certain different things that were like overtly different from our land. Whereas this one, it kind of just felt like it didn't. To me, it didn't feel too dissimilar to like a planet you might see on Guardians of the Galaxy film.
Yeah, agree.
Yeah, true.
But. Yeah, I do appreciate it. They did try to do it in some instances, but I just think they didn't quite commit as hard as I thought they would. I think that... sorry, I'm just trying to gather my thoughts because I feel like I have a lot to say, but not a lot to say at the same time.
Honestly, the more I think about this film, the more I've got to say about it. And it's not okay. Good stuff.
Do you want to jump in there then, Chris?
No, only if Obi's...
You might ignite
right.
Some...
Fine, I'll go for it. I'm gonna just absolutely rinse this film because I gave it a 6, but actually I'm thinking I'm signing more with Sarah and I'm in line with a 4. I think this film, like, I was expecting so much from it to start off this whole Kang the Conqueror. I don't mind that Kang the Conqueror is somewhat defeated in this film, because obviously it sets up future films. However, I do think that there's a lot of threads that, for this film to be based on this interdimensional energy source, they didn't really hone in on how unique it was. Mm. Because if it's so unique that he can't make it, right, he's so smart and he can't make it, yeah, then we're like, okay, there's only one in this world, right? But I'm assuming there's not one in this world, evidently because of the ending of the film where all the Kangs get together. Now, maybe there's one sanctum, one place that they can do it. Sanctum's not the right word, but maybe there's one place they can do it and they can just all get there and it's easy. But the fact that him and, always forget the lady's name, managed to recreate the interdimensional travel energy from not just the stuff that he crashed with, but other elements, because they got stuck a few times. They made a point to show they got stuck and that she helped him then to fix it. So the fact that she's able to do that, and in the time she's been gone and he stayed down there, created a magnificent looking world with all these technological advances, you're telling me he could not make or remake that serum? That makes absolutely no sense to me. But I just, that's a big plot hole, I think, in this thing. So they even needed to make it so uniquely difficult to get, and they should have gone for a treasure hunt together, going through desolate land. Maybe that's where they could have introduced the different biomes of the quantum realm, where they went through it and found the different pieces and they put it together. And then she did the big, oh, I'm going to make it big, small, whatever, confuse the shit out of him. But for all that technology he has, you're telling me he can't make the Pym particle? I can get around it by saying, yeah, maybe Pym particle can only be created in the open world, not the quantum realm. Maybe. But I feel like it's a real, like, there's a lot of plot holes, and we've really, I think I'm not mad that he's been defeated, because he's gone against five really smart people they're all smart, so I don't mind him losing to them because they are smart people. But I think there's two big points there that make it so this film is just irrelevant and it doesn't really make sense.
I think they missed a massive opportunity with this variant of Kang. they could have quite easily let him win, because what I obviously don't know the comics very well, and I know that there are several versions of Kang, but he is Kang the Conqueror.
Yes, or so we think.
Well, yeah, but apart from the 20-second montage we see when Janet touches the orb, we don't actually see the villainy that much. We don't, apart from like him threatening Cassie and, you know.
He did kill a few people at the end. He literally killed people.
But so does every villain. Like, for me, like, he's, you know, they're saying, oh, Kang's the big bad of Phase 5. But I kind of hoped that there would be a dominant version of Kang, because for me, if every version of Kang we see will just end up dying and then there's another version, that to me is not the same villain. And it also doesn't suggest that this villain is as powerful as someone like Thanos. If Kang, maybe we will see this version of Kang again. We don't really necessarily know that he's died, but I just felt it very anticlimactic. There was a massive opportunity for them to show us a little bit more of the villainy, the conquering, even the dictatorship over the quantum realm. We don't really see any of that. Like you alluded to, we don't really see that much of his journey with Janet. All of this stuff would have been really interesting, and far much more interesting than most of the stuff we got in this film.
Yeah.
And then the fact that, I mean, look, I know it's Ant-Man and it's silly, but he got overrun by a battalion of ants. I didn't really like that very much. I felt he was defeated far too easily, considering he's killed Thor and all his other Avengers. Like, I hope at some point we get to see flashbacks to when he does kill Thor or whatever, but kind of feel like we're not. I think if you know, we might get a Kang in every bloody film up until the Kang Dynasty, but if they're not the same ones, then to me, it's not really giving, like, putting fear into me, being like, oh, he's a good villain. Because it's kind of like if Tony Stark had all his different versions of his suit come out and fly, and in each one, the suit was there and then died, and you're like, oh, well, I just know there's gonna be another one, so it doesn't really matter. Like, it didn't feel consequential to me.
Yeah. I think I agree with you, because I think in the lead, I think the problem we've got is that we've got, I would say, this is going to be a bold statement, I feel, but I would say in the phase 1 to 3 of Thanos, we got 60% good to amazing films. I think there's 40% that probably are probably underwhelming and scene setting or filmmaking, just for the sake of scene setting and filmmaking. And I feel like we had a guy that people knew about, but in the actual film series, we didn't know much about Thanos. We heard about him, we briefly saw him, and then boom, he's there and he destroys shit. Now in this one, we've got, we've seen Kang as somewhat of a nice guy. You could say he's a bit of a conqueror himself because he's made it so there's no other timeline splits and he's kept the TVA in line and all this stuff. And then you've got this other Kang who's supposedly destroyed different universes. So I think the fact that we've got so much of him, he's not going to be so maybe as menacing, or they're going to have to make it so there's scenes where he is more so menacing throughout the series, the films. And maybe he'll do that in Loki, because that's where the start of Kang the Conqueror came, didn't it? At the end of Loki season one. But I think this film also, a big thing that was probably hindering this film is that in my mind, and again, I could be wrong, people might think different, but I think genuinely there's probably like 5 main characters in this film. And I think that's too many. For a film that's meant to be about Ant-Man, you've got him, his daughter, Hank, Janet, his girlfriend, and then you've got Kang, who everyone's trying to focus on. Actually, it's probably 6. And we're trying to follow these characters and build a story of like how these characters feel. And I don't think it worked. I didn't feel much empathy for Janet's story and like her whereabouts within the quantum realm. And it was actually like, I know they do it for storytelling purposes, but it was pissing me off she wouldn't tell him anything. I was like, if you had just told him, or if you give him a bit more information, they can do as they like, they can do something with it. You're just being so blasé about it. And I was just like, I don't know, just it didn't work well for me. Like, I just don't know. Like, I think they needed to do Ant-Man, have a little bit of the Wasp, Hank and Janet, do a bit of a storytelling with Cassie, because obviously they're going to try and push her for like Young Avengers or something. But they should have focused on Ant-Man. I'm not saying he would have been a make or break, but then maybe we could get a bit more impact scenes with him, and maybe a bit more impact scenes with him and Kang. Now, I'm sure there could be arguments against that in, as we talk, but I just feel like there's too much going on in too many different places. And I've got other bugbears, but I'll let you two talk a bit more about other bits. But
Obi, what were your thoughts on Kang?
On Kang, I think the performance is good. I think it's different to when he was in Loki as He Who Remains, which is good. I think he was quite menacing, I would say, and I think he kind of displayed his villainy in a not overt way, through kind of like dialogue and kind of like, body language, which I think is good. But I would have liked to have seen or known more of his background. When they did the flashback with him and Janet, and she kind of like sees the vision of like all his stuff he's conquered, I thought that was a cool scene. I would have liked to have been expanded a bit more. I think I agree with you, Glenn, in saying that I think he was defeated too easily, and it would be better if he had won this time around, because then you know that the villain you're going to face is, or at least one of the villains you're going to face is someone who's not to be messed with, and maybe you could even somehow tie in a post credit where you kind of get the thinking of, oh, we lost to him and he's not even the worst Kang we're going to face, kind of thing.
Mm.
I think could have been a bit more interesting. The fact that at the end this kind of boils down to a fist fight between Kang and Ant-Man / Hope, I think is a bit redundant. And I would hope for something maybe a bit more clever, considering, you know, Ant-Man's not particularly known for being a fist fighter as well. I was, I wasn't disappointed by Kang, but I was hoping for a bit more generally. But I don't think that's the actor's fault. I think that's the writing issue, to be honest with you. And I did hear that apparently apparently this film was a bit more violent. So apparently that was cut out. Also one thing as well. I think they didn't really explain Kang's powers, I guess. I mean, not that he had powers, but when they were in the prison and he was kind of like, I don't know what he was doing. He was like lifting them up in Cassie and Scott, that is, and like manipulating them and kind of putting them in pain, presumably. And he also, Janet tried to run away at one point and he froze her. And then kind of like, I was thinking like, okay, how's he done that? Are they going to explain that? And it didn't really. So I would have liked to have got a bit more of an explanation as to kind of like what he is able to do and what he's not able to do. Because if you could freeze people, why didn't you freeze Scott and then just walk through the fucking thing at the end?
That's a very good point.
I do think
at the end though, they didn't do it very well, but I feel like at the end they tried to show him as more like a human character, that he was somewhat defeated to the point where his suit's essentially given him the powers, right?
I assume so, but it would have been nice for them to that was the case, kind of thing.
Yeah, I agree.
It would even have been a better ending if he had got through the portal.
Yeah.
The portal closed, I was like, oh, Ant-Man and Hope are going to be stuck there. And then
that would have been sick. That would have been good. I would have liked that.
5 seconds later, oh, it's open again.
Yeah.
That also doesn't make sense, by the way.
No, it doesn't. And I've got a lot wrong with this film. I really didn't like Cassie. I thought she was so annoying.
Me too.
I
found it very self-righteous. When she was like, sorry, just to interrupt you really quickly. So when she was like, to Scott. Scott was like, I saved the fucking world. And she's like, oh, but what are you doing now? You're not doing anything now. It's like, relax, bro. He helped save trillions of lives and you're giving him shit. Like, relax, man.
Yeah, what did you do in the 5 years apart from get arrested and, you know, fuck around in the quantum realm? It's ridiculous. A little bit more backstory about what she was doing as well, because, like, we see her in Endgame and there's no suggestion that she's this, like, genius. Yet, now he is. I also think it's harsh on that original actress that she got recast, because I don't necessarily think Catherine Newton brought anything amazing to the role.
Right.
I alluded to it in my synopsis. I fucking hated MODOK.
I thought it was... Oh, I hated...
It was so shit.
Oh, God.
Visual effects. I mean, like, showing it once or twice is like, okay, this is funny, because he's supposed to be a ridiculous character.
Yeah.
But when you focus so much on that, like, bloated, awful, like, visual effect face, oh my god. And I didn't have any kind of sympathy for him at the end when he's like, I just don't want to be a dick. Like, well, you are, mate. And
She's like, just don't be a dick. I'm like, Jesus, come on, man. Be oaf.
I'm annoyed that I laughed when he said, when he said, oh, at least I'll die in Avenger. I laughed at that, I'm not going to lie. I laughed at it because it was so
funny. Yeah.
As well about MODOK, I just think like they leaned hard on that for like comedic effect and kind of like him being taken as a joke. But the more it went on, the more kind of like you could see how they were taking the piss out of him. It just made me even more annoyed. I just didn't get anything out of it. And I'm really annoyed because one thing I'll say about this film is that the score was not good. I noticed that dramatically. I was like, the music in this is not captivating me in any way, shape or form, apart from when MODOK dies. And I was like, you've used the best part of the music for when this fucking character dies. And that annoyed me as well.
Was there anything we liked about this film apart from Jonathan Majors' performance, which was very good?
Yeah, it was very good.
I thought some of the CGI was pretty good. Also,
any kind of examples? Because I felt I always pick up more on bad CGI.
Right. So I thought that so when they were, so I think it's the first battle, I suppose, when they're Cassie and Scott are with the rebels. I need to talk about those rebels for a second, actually. But when they come to them, and then Kang comes to fight them, and then Action and Cass, and Scott's like teaching Cassie how to jump properly and stuff like that. I thought that was a pretty cool scene visually. I thought that looked pretty cool. And then there was one in particular where I think it was like a flashback sort of thing, and it was talking about how when Kang building the Empire kind of thing, and it was like all his robots or servants or whatever they are, and he was like overlooking the. His like quantum realm, which I thought was pretty visually pretty cool as well.
Before you talk about the rebels,
yeah,
which is another Star Wars phrase, you refer to his empire. Did you see any? I saw a few similarities with like Vader.
What with
Kang?
With Kang.
Mm. I don't know. Maybe I was just like, oh, this looks so Star Wars.
Well, you could even say like when Scott and Cassie are captured and he's like levitating them and shit, that's straight out of Darth Vader.
That's the Force, mate.
Yeah. So you could definitely say there's definitely an homage to Star Wars in this, I would say. For sure.
Anyway, the Rebels.
Yeah, the Rebels. So one thing about the Rebels. They saw Scott and Cassie, captured them. Then when Kang and them lot came, they were like, oh, you led them straight to us. And I was like, you brought them here. Like, what the fuck? Anyway.
Yeah, that's so stupid.
That was just nuts. But I think those rebels and, like, their story and everything like that, I found actually quite interesting. But we don't know anything about any of them. So you don't care about any of them. You've got, like, this warrior woman who's supposed to be presumably, like, the leader of this kind of, this rebel alliance or whatever. And you've got, like, there's essentially them, you've got Chidi from The Good Place, you've got the little blob thing, and you've got the geezer with the, who's like a machine, but he's got, like, I don't know, fire in his face or whatever. And they were, like, a little ragtag team. And I felt like, in a different film, with different, take out all the Ant-Man characters, replace them with, I don't know, one unknown character, and you plot, I felt like, if you took those characters, that setting, the rebels, Kang, da da da, and just plopped that in a different film that wasn't connected to Ant-Man, you could have got something actually really quite decent. But you've just got, like, these four different characters who, you know, you've got the blob thing, Shane, I've got holes at the end, which I guess was funny, I guess. But, and the guy, and Chidi, he can read minds and stuff like that. And these people are interesting, I think, anyway. But you're there only on screen, like, two or three times in the whole two-hour film. And it's like, well, why are they even in it then? Why should I care about these rebels? Why should I care about what Kang has done to them when you don't really give us any backstory apart from a bit of exposition at the beginning?
Yeah. I think James Gunn would have probably dealt with it better because he's got that experience with the ensemble. And one of you mentioned earlier something about Guardians feel. But yeah, I mean, he gave like Taserface a bit of a backstory. Do you know what I mean? Like,
exactly. I think Chris was saying about the kind of there being too many main characters. I do agree for sure. But I also think that like with that, for example, Hope, or the Wasp, for example, is she has like five lines in this whole film. Like she's barely in it, and the film's called Ant-Man and the Wasp. Like, if you're gonna have all these people in the film and then do like two or three of the characters dirty, just don't put them in the film.
Yeah,
doesn't make sense. Was shit as well. Sorry. Go on.
Yeah, and I was just gonna say they gave Hank Pym bare screen time. I thought way more than he needed.
Definitely, I agree. I thought the ants thing progressing over 1,000 years, blah blah blah, I thought that was ridiculous. That pissed me off. I saw that
coming from the beginning though, because you just saw that whole ant farm. He made a point to say it at the beginning.
Yeah.
Then you on purpose see the whole ant farm get sucked in, and then you see the ants in front of them. I was like,
they're definitely
coming back. I was like, but why are they so large?
Well, I suppose it's relative, isn't it? I don't mind the ant coming back and helping out. That's fine. That makes sense. It's Ant-Man. That's cool. That's basically what happened in the first film. The annoys me thing is, oh, they survived for thousands of years and they advanced as a fucking, and they built technology. I'm like, what? Come on, man. This is so dumb. That annoyed me. That's the only thing about it.
Again, links to my point about how did Kang the Conqueror, who lived how many years there, not create the city and not create the technology he needs, yet some ants create world beater technology and can live for thousands of years. Can ants live for thousands of years?
Didn't the ants get there at the same time as Scott and Hank?
No, they got time vortex or something.
And that's another thing. It's like, you know, the quantum realm is so unstable that the chances of all of them being spat out at the same place doesn't really make any sense any either. But
they did grab onto each other, so you've got like.
Yeah, but not but I get what you mean. Scott and Cassie, but Hope, Janet, and Hank were separate. There's a lot that you can pick holes in this. I really did enjoy it. Genuinely might be worse than Thor Love and Thunder.
Don't think so.
I mean,
no chance.
It's not too much better if it is. I just think I was just disappointed. Like, I was hoping Kang would be some like big villain. And like you say, there's villainous things and he's menacing and it's well acted, but he was just massively undermined by this. Like, even if it's the same Kang the Conqueror, Ant-Man defeated him on his own. Almost. What, you're telling me the Avengers aren't going to just go click their fingers and he's going to be like super?
They need, honestly, that I think they there's a whole scene they needed in this film. Unless I just missed it and it was a one-liner. They needed a scene to show him nerfed in this quantum realm. That's the only thing that would explain his shit. Like, obviously, he great actor and all that, and he did very well making them fear him. But in terms of his power, I didn't feel the presence of his power there. I felt that he made people feel like if they didn't listen to him, he would kill them. I felt that kind of power. But in terms of, like, one-to-one combat, it was definitely nerfed, and they just didn't explain why.
Yeah, I agree.
And I feel like at the end scene, where the other Kangs discuss how this Kang's been defeated, so can they see this Kang?
Yes.
Do they have the technology to go into the quantum realm?
Probably.
They sent him there,
didn't they?
Yeah, as a prison.
Yeah.
But like, they sent him there with a ship that could get him out of there, which equally doesn't make any sense.
That doesn't make sense to me at all.
It literally makes no sense. They gave him they sent him down with the ability to get out. I still don't really understand why he needed Janet's help to fix his ship if he's so smart. He's like Reed Richards' descendant for the year 3000. There's something else. Oh, sorry, did I cut off someone actually? Sorry.
No. I was going to say one thing that I hated. Sorry
for it.
This is when Scott gets really big.
You're about to say what I was going to say, so go for it. I fucking hate it as well.
Oh, okay. Oh, no, I think we're going to say different things actually, but.
Okay, go on then.
So Scott gets really big and then he's like, and I just think the line delivery is awful. Scott is like screaming, he's screaming like, Kang, we had a deal. Our word is our bond. And I'm like, Scott, what the fuck are you talking about? You weren't going to give him the thing in the first place. Why are you making noise like this? It wound me up. And I was like, I thought the line delivery was terrible. And yeah, that just got my nerves. And Chris, I feel like I know what you're going to say now, but go ahead.
Yeah, like in the middle of fucking fighting, Cassie and giant Ant-Man just suddenly hug each other and have this like little moment. I'm like, what the hell? What is going on? This makes no sense.
I also didn't like that because I don't know why they filmed it this way, but when they were both hugging as giants, inverted commas, you couldn't tell that they were giant because
no,
the background.
No, you're exactly right. I was going to agree with you. I was like, oh, they're giant, are they? Because the whole kind of scope and scale of this film is very confusing because, you know, they're super small, yet everything's presented as like it's normal size. And then, I don't think they reference the height and scale of things very well.
Also, didn't they make a point to say it's very, very hard to make yourself giant in the first or second film? And Cassie, although she did struggle afterwards, she held her own pretty well for someone who's probably never made the jump to going big before.
Do you know what my thing is as well? Sorry, Chris, I completely agree with you, I think it was Ant-Man 2 they introduced that rule. Or maybe it was Avengers. But it was Captain America, actually, Civil War. Anyway, is when they get super big, why are they not, like, super big? Like, why don't they get big as in, like, they burst out of this whole fucking world kind of thing? Do you know what I mean? Like, why is it big only to that quantum realm scale? Why is it not big to Earth scale? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I get you say. There must be some limit that we're not aware of.
There's not really much consistency with how they present these things, because there was one of the films, he got so small he went quantum, yet within the quantum realm he sized down 5 times. I'm conscious of times, and there's lots of other stuff that we want to discuss. Is there any final concluding thoughts? Mine would probably be that it doesn't fill me with tons of hope for Phase 5, which is a shame.
My final thoughts would be, do you know what? I actually do want to watch this film again just to see if I dislike it as much as I think I do. Not that I dislike it, I just think it's a bit, it feels really empty, I think. Like, I don't get any feeling, good feeling from it, or bad feeling, really. It's just feeling. And also, I liked the post-credit scene, the second one, was about Loki and led into Loki, which means that finally the TV shows have consequences to the actual movie world. It's great.
Yeah,
true.
I actually didn't mind the end credit scenes. I thought the one where he was, well, not the food part, that part was a bit whatever, but him having the inner thoughts of, oh no, that wasn't even an end credit scene, was it? That was just the end of the film. Yeah. I didn't mind that part. I thought that was quite...
What was the other scene? Council of Kangs.
Yeah.
The what? The Council of
Kangs.
All the Kangs.
Oh, yeah, that was cool. That was all right. What was I going to say?
Also, where was her mum in all of this? Cassie's mum, that is.
She's got fridge.
Like, even her fake birthday, not birthday. She won't even know. Anyway.
What was I going to say? Shit, that's going to hurt me.
And where was Louise? I needed Louise in this film.
That's it. That's what I was going to say, yes. He should have done a little story at the end of the beginning. Like I won't take credit for saying that one, because Sarah mentioned that after we watched the film, but that would have been cool, I think. They added that in, like him telling the story of how Ant-Man survived the quantum realm, or what Ant-Man's been doing in the meantime since Avengers.
Apparently
they didn't have enough screen time for him or something. Cause like,
this film was minutes. Not that long. This film was just over 2 hours, wasn't it?
Mm.
Oi, free TI as well. Where's the dope boys at?
Free TI.
I'll be honest, but when I left the cinema, I was giving this a 6.5.
Ooh.
I'm thinking the more I grill it, the more I want to give it like a 5.5. But then I think it did somewhat entertain me. Whether it was coherent or it made any sense to other Ant-Man films, maybe not. But it somewhat entertained me, so I feel like it's got to get an above average score.
I'll give it, yeah.
And if we're saying average 5 isn't actually an average, and 6 is more like an average, then it's probably going to get a 6.
I would agree with that. And I also, I think I comfortably like this film more than Thor, Love and Thunder.
Yeah, 100%. I think Thor, Love and Thunder missed the mark, like 10, 20, like, I don't think it hit the mark properly on any of it.
They're both films where the villain is a better portrayal than the rest of it. So we don't have too long to wait until Guardians. There's no word I'm aware of when Loki season 2 is coming out, but you know, the end credit scene suggests that it's probably not too far away.
Do you see that? Sorry guys, do you see that the Marvels got pushed back?
Yeah.
Yeah, I saw that.
Don't know what that says about that film. But right, let's talk about something non-Marvel. So there's I got a chance to watch The Whale. My local cinema was finally showing it. Brendan Fraser is up for best actor. Although I don't know whether the BAFTAs are any indication, but Austin Butler won the BAFTA for best actor for his portrayal of Elvis. But anyway, I personally think that Brendan Fraser's in with a good shout based on watching The Whale. So, can't remember, Obi, if you talked about it on the pod. Apologies if you did. Did you summarise it?
Yeah, I think I did.
Okay, so let's assume that the listener knows the story of The Whale. Chris, are you going to watch it? Do you mind if we go into details?
I will eventually watch it, but you can go to as many details as possible.
Okay. I mean, I didn't really know what to expect with this film going in. I had heard mixed reviews about it, and I can't remember what your take on it was, Obi. So that didn't necessarily sway me. But I heard some people really love it, and some people say it was a bit stagey, because I know it is based on a play. And so I didn't really have any expectations other than the fact that, you know, Brendan Fraser was up for Best Actor. But I, for the most part, really enjoyed it. I found his portrayal very moving. It did actually make me tear up, particularly towards the end. I felt that pretty much all of the four main characters' performances were really strong. I thought Sadie Sink, as his daughter, was really good. Like, I think, you know, people playing angsty teens can wear quite thin, but I think that she played it really well. Also, that kind of reserve, like, she's putting on an angsty front, but actually she does care in some regards. Hong Chao as his friend and kind of nurse Liz, she was really good. Also Ty Simpkins as the kind of missionary, I thought, you know, I just believed all of them as their characters.
What else is he in?
He was in Endgame very briefly.
Endgame very briefly. Who was he?
He was the kid who was in Iron Man 3.
Oh, yes, yes, yes.
So he's now grown up.
He's got
Yeah. Because I literally was like, is that Ty Simpkins? Mm. But yeah, it was. I had to Google it afterwards. I also think, like, it would be quite easy for this to be a bit of a pastiche of very overweight people. Mm. And there are some, you know, jokes at his expense. But I feel like for the most part, it was quite, it dealt with it quite tenderly. And the fact that he, you know, they explain his overeating as like you see the scenes of him comforting himself when he's been upset by just gorging on food to the point that he's sick. And, you know, to that regard, it was kind of treated as like a mental health issue or like self-harm. I mean, he was self-harming in that regard. And, you know, it kind of made me think, like, I was getting angry at Hong Chao's character because I was like, you're literally telling him that he's dying, yet you are buying him these meatball subs and you're watching him choke. And then once you've saved his life, you then give him the fucking meatball sub back. And so it kind of made me angry in that regard. But also, obviously, she loves him and she's hurting from the loss of his partner, like her brother, his partner. And then just other things like the kind of shame he feels at his size, and he doesn't want his students to see him. And he says to a few of them, like, do you find me disgusting? And I found that very, like, powerful as well, because it was all in his eyes. I felt that his eyes, Brendan Fraser's eyes, gave like a really strong performance, because obviously, like, you can't really see his natural body, and he sits down quite a lot, so it's all in the facial expressions. And yeah, I don't know, I was really surprised by how effective I found it. And for that reason, I gave it a very high score, because it moved me and I believed pretty much all the characters. I think it fell down when the mother turns up, that then became very stagey, and the way that she delivered her lines was very much like a play. Very much like random outbursts of drama. But it kind of pulled it back right at the end.
What did you take from the end? Do you think he died at that point?
Yes, yes. Hmm. He died, and he died listening to his favourite essay, and he had that memory of them by the beach.
Mm.
Yeah. So remind me what you thought of it.
I liked it. I don't think I liked it as much as you did, to be fair, but I did like it. I thought that Brendan Fraser was good in it, but a part of me was watching it. And this is the thing, because I'm kind of I was watching it through the lens of I'm prepared to be like amazed by this performance because of the hype it's gotten. And it didn't quite live up to that. So that's probably, maybe that's my fault for kind of like going in with those expectations, quite lofty expectations. But I thought he was very good. I didn't like the ending. even like if it is that he, I don't know, it just felt kind of like, it felt like how if I was trying to write this film and try and do that ending, it felt like how I would do it. And I'm not a filmmaker. It just kind of felt like really like amateur, not amateur, but like, I don't know, like, oh, he's lifted up off the ground and then it all plays to Wyatt. And I'm like, what? Like, that feels like something that I would do. But yeah, I don't know. I didn't love that. Everything leading up to it, I thought was great. I think him kind of like trying to, I suppose, have this relationship with his daughter by like any means sort of thing was good. I thought the two of them had good chemistry, obviously, despite kind of like what was actually going on in the film. Like you said, I think Sadie Sink was really good as like this quite antagonistic character, and she kind of like pushes everyone's buttons, no matter who you are, kind of thing.
Yeah.
I thought that was really strong performance from her. I had the same thought with you about his friend / his partner's brother, sister, sorry, about like why are you enabling him, kind of thing. But
I also found it really heartbreaking when the pizza guy, you know, they kind of become friends through the door.
Yeah.
And then he kind of waits to see him and he's actually visibly disgusted by him.
Yeah.
And I felt like the film was very much about Charlie, Brendan Fraser's character, trying to get connection with people, but also having that intense insecurity about the way he looks. And then that, to me, it was like, it validated why he feels like that.
Yeah.
I just found it very sad.
It was very sad. And like, because of the way, you know, obviously you only hear the deliverer guy's voice, but because of the way it was going, I thought he's going to see him and he's going to be like, oh, hey, man, or something like that. And
yeah.
Kind of thing. And then, yeah, like you say, he sees him and then he's like, looks at him in that way and then just walks off. And I'm like, oh, man, like you could have been kind of like the thing to help him turn it around, kind of thing. And then you just kind of like added on to everything that he was feeling, which was quite sad.
I also think what's even more like powerful is he's on a second floor flat.
Mm.
There is no way he's getting down those stairs.
Yeah.
So like he is literally trapped there. Yeah. So yeah, I don't know. I think I've now seen 4 of the 5 best actor performances, and I would want him to win.
That's fair.
But maybe I'm just getting a bit more emotional because I was watching Marcel the Shell with Shoes On, and that was getting me. It's a fucking little stop motion shell. But yeah, I mean that's a really good film as well. I'll talk about that very, very quickly. Sorry, was there anything else you wanted to say about The Whale?
No, not really. Not really. I think you covered it all pretty much.
I wish I was more literary because I feel like there's got to be some allegory with Charlie and the whale from Moby Dick.
Right. Yeah.
But I was trying to think. I don't really know the story apart from the very basic bones. So I was trying to think, oh, what are they trying to say? Is he Moby Dick or what is it? But yeah, I'm sure some scholar will tell us. But I'll very quickly talk about Marcel the Shell, and then I want to hear what you two thought about Plane. So Marcel the Shell with Shoes On it's basically presented as a documentary, a live action documentary, but the focus of it is a stop motion shell. 1-inch high shell with one eye and shoes. It's based on a series of short films that director Dean Fleischer-Kamp and Jenny Slate, who voices Marcel, made over 10 years ago. And this is basically a feature-length version. So the premise is Marcel lives in this house, which is now an Airbnb because the owners split up and, you know, in the breakup, Marcel got separated from the rest of his shell family because they all took refuge in the sock drawer when they were arguing, and the sock drawer got dumped into a suitcase. And so Marcel is just living there with his grandma, who has got dementia, and basically the director, Dean, moves into the house, which is now rented as an Airbnb, finds Marcel and is like, oh, I'm going to make a documentary about you. And then he like helps him try and find his family. But it's such a optimistic and sweet film. I did wonder how they would long it out to an hour and a half, but there's like scenes of how Marcel gets around. Like he goes inside a tennis ball and then like bumps himself down the stairs and all these like little how he navigates normal tasks like getting food and water and things like that, and how he looks after his nan, who he has to keep repeating things to because she's getting forgetful. And the voice is very kind of sweet, but not annoying sweet. And it's just, like, Marcel was just such an optimistic character that it was really hard not to, you know, really kind of feel for this tiny shell.
What made you start to watch this?
I just liked the title.
Fair enough.
I was like, I want to watch a film about a shell with shoes on. It sounded like whimsical and...
Yeah.
It was. There's a lot of this, and you're like, oh, that's really cool. Cute. And, like, you know, he kind of says to the director, like, oh, where do you go to get up high? Because I go to the mantelpiece and I can see the whole room. And the director goes, oh, because the director is basically playing himself in the film as well. And he goes, oh, we can go up to the top of the hill in LA or whatever. And then they get up there, and Marcel's vomiting on the way because it's so much juddering in the car.
Right.
And he goes, oh, so is this the whole world then? He goes, no, this is just a town, which is in a city, which is in the country. And it's just that whole, you know, you kind of see the world through Marcel's eyes. And it's so, yeah, I guess, innocent. And, yeah, I don't know. I really liked it. I was really surprised. I was clearly in some sort of feels. But, yeah, it's a really, really good film. And it deals with some really heavy themes, but in a way that I think is palatable for children, but also doesn't ostracize adults.
Yeah.
So go and watch Marcel the Shell with Shoes On.
Is it new?
I mean, so this came out in America 2 years ago, but it's only just been released in the UK.
Okay. I might be watching.
It's up for Best Animated Film.
Okay.
Have
you watched Pinocchio yet? I still need to watch that.
No, I haven't. I do need to watch that.
Yeah,
I haven't watched Puss in Boots either. But I want to hear about Plane, which is getting a sequel called Ship.
Is that? Are you taking a piss?
No, it's actually getting a sequel called Ship.
That's bare funny. Chris, take it away. If you're there.
Chris?
Yeah, I was saying stuff and no one was answering, so I just assumed you couldn't hear me.
We couldn't. No, sorry.
Oh, no. Sorry.
Oh, that's all right. No worries.
Plane. Talk us through Plane.
Me?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Spotlight's on you.
Oh, yeah. So it's a plane journey where you think the co-pilot is going to die because he tells us about his family and his wife. And there's about 10 passengers on this plane, with one supposed criminal. I don't even remember where they're going. Do you remember where they're going, Obi?
I don't know, you know, I think maybe Hawaii or something like that.
Maybe, yeah. So they're taking on a passenger that they don't really want to, but they're doing it anyway. And then our plane driver decides to take a quicker route. He's just telling his passengers he's going to. And then
So before the flight was coming, he could see that there was a storm brewing, and then he calls up the guy and says, can you give us an alternate route, kind of thing, because I don't really want to fly through this. And the guy's like, nah, fly through it, just get to 10,000 feet away.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
And he has to tell the passengers that they're about to fly through the storm, and he's like, oh, just so you know, to the passengers, we have to fly through the storm, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, fine. And then basically they lose, like, all navigational help, all contact to the airport, no one can assist them. I think one of their engines has somewhat blown or isn't in use, and they basically have to crash land on, I don't even remember where, but they have to basically try and land safely. Yeah, in the Philippines. So they do that. Mid-flight, the police or the agent who's looking after the convict or the person who's going to be convicted, he decides, because his phone's fallen out of his hand or something, he's going to undo his seatbelt while they're in turbulence
what
and try and grab his phone. The stewardess, who was told by her fellow stewardess not to go get out her seat. She was going to tell the guy off and basically say, get back in his seat. As the flight, the plane juddered, he hit the ceiling and fell and hit the ground and died. And she flew up in the air and her neck snapped on the back of a seat. So they basically both died. And then they landed. They covered their bodies up. And then, who's the main actor in this?
Gerard Butler.
And Luke Cage decide they're going to go and explore the island while the rest of the passengers get off the plane and just chill. And during this time, I don't know what you'd want to call them, a gang?
I said militia.
Militia, yeah. Decide to interrogate and attack and kill some of the passengers. And our two main characters are somewhere else attacking some of the militia. Then they come back. All the passengers get taken away to the militia's buildings site. And yeah, then Gerard Butler goes to save them, gets saved. During this time, the airport people are setting up a task force to come and save them all. Task force gets there. Gerard Butler gives himself up so the passengers can all escape and get back to the plane. The mercenaries come. They save Gerard Butler's character. There's a big shootout right by the plane. And I can't remember Luke Cage's character's name in the thing, but basically he saves them from getting blown up by a rocket, and he ends up, I don't know for what reason he wants to stay on this island, but obviously not going
to prison. He's about to be convicted.
Yeah. But like he stayed on this nutty island with a load of money and some guns. And that's the end of the story, pretty much.
Yeah.
And the rest of them survived. There was a moment where Gerard Butler's character is just sitting on the plane. And I don't know why he decided to sit on the plane.
Yeah.
And I thought he was going to die or something.
Same.
And then he just gets up, gets off the plane, looks at everyone. No one really nods at him everyone faints him, but no one really nods at him. And he's like looking at people, and he just sits back down on the plane, steps again.
Bear in mind, at this point, he'd been shot 3 times.
Yeah, and that as well. Yeah.
And he's just chilling. Yeah. I'm like, fucking hell, I get to a hostel.
Yeah, like everyone else is getting looked after, and he's just sitting there like, yeah, I'm going to go room my daughter.
Sounds terrible. Sounds like the most Gerard Butler film ever, but
it's worse than that, I would say.
Yeah, it's definitely worse than that. Yeah,
I think the Gerard Butler films, in most ones he's seen, he's normally like the full throttle action, do whatever it takes to complete whatever objective I need to get kind of guy. In this one, he's kind of like half-hearted, like he don't really want to kill people and stuff like that. And I'm like, come on, man! Like it's Luke Cage who's the one who's like killing people, and he's kind of like half-hearted.
And he saved Gerard Butler's life because Gerard Butler was going to go running in while his passengers were like, one of the passengers was getting killed. And he pushed him down to the ground. He's like, what are you doing? Just chill, relax. There's no point in you dying as well as them. But it was a great film. Yeah. Could have been better.
Will you be tuning in for Ship?
Probably.
I mean, I'll probably watch it, but it's only because it's a short, easy film. Not really one that you have to really engage your brain for.
Mm. Apparently Ship is going to focus on Mike Coulter's character.
Interesting.
Okay. That could be more interesting, to be fair.
Ben, can you look up how much money this film made? Because I can't believe it made enough for them to sanction a sequel.
Well, the budget was $25 million and they've made $48 million.
Fair enough.
When you put it
like that, it's like, oh, is that that much? But when you think about it, like, 20-odd million is good amounts of money, isn't it?
It's made almost double its budget, so... Yeah. I mean, is Gerard Butler basically doing a Liam Neeson just several years earlier?
In what sense? Like, he's just doing all the same types of film?
Just the Jerry action, isn't it? Like, just, yeah. Just rinse and repeat, like...
Probably.
You could argue that. I can't remember what film he was in. Was it Greenland?
Yeah, that was all right.
That was all right.
That was like the apocalyptic one. He was in one not that long ago as well, where he was in a prison.
I never watched it.
Chop, I chop, did. That's it. Yeah. So, yeah. Something like that. And yeah, that was fine. I've not seen the last Fallen one, whatever, whichever one that was. And I never saw Geostorm. Wow. I'm just on Gerard Butler's Wikipedia page, and under awards and nominations, right? There is, so he was nominated in 2007 the MTV Movie Award for Best Fight. He was then also Golden Raspberry Award for Worst Actor. Nice. There's something about one of the worst screen couple. Yeah, I mean, why you would have this as your list, whoever's curating this is not doing. It was up for Worst Foreign Actor at the Yoga Awards. Go figure. That was Plane. We've probably got time to quickly talk about Knock at the Cabin. Did I talk about this before?
I don't think so.
Okay. Knock at the Cabin. It is the latest M. Night Shyamalan film. Who's done things like Old, Glass, Sixth Sense, you know. He's the king of twists. And the twist this time is that there isn't a twist. Which I'm not mad at, to be honest, because you kind of... I think in that sense, you know, you're expecting this big twist, and when it doesn't come, it kind of, in and of itself, becomes a twist. So this is the story of a same-sex couple who are holidaying in a cabin in the woods with their daughter, Wen, and... pretty quickly, they are, they have a knock at the cabin. And it is a four-person team who are basically telling them that the apocalypse is coming and that the family, Eric, Andrew, and Wen, have to make a choice to willingly sacrifice one of them in order to prevent the apocalypse. And if they don't make this decision, then there will be four plagues that come and destroy the world. So that's the basic premise. And it stars Dave Bautista as Leonard, who's the kind of head horseman. It's also got Rupert Grint as one of the others. And I really liked this film. I found the premise really interesting. It's quite easy to put yourself in the character's shoes and be like, what would I do in this situation? You know, initially, like, and initially you kind of think, well, it's, these people are obviously crazy. Like, they're not gonna, you know, the world is not ending. They're kind of mentally ill or just batshit or whatever, religious fanatics, whatever. And I think the characters are quite well written in the sense that, Eric and Andrew, I felt had realistic conversations about what, like, what someone in real life would do in that situation. Like, they're tied to the chair and Andrew is the more kind of level-headed one, and he's like, this is just not going to happen. It's not true. And then so when they decide not to sacrifice one of them, Rupert Grint's character Redmond is then it has to commit suicide or is then killed by the other horseman. And then they say, right, well, the first plague is going to come. And they turn on the TV and they say, look, the flood's about to come. They've all apparently had this shared vision. And then they turn on the TV and there's a tsunami happens. But the group are still like, well, that could be a coincidence. This footage could be old. Like, we don't know. Like, they just don't buy it. And then they keep making these decisions not to sacrifice one of their group. And then, you know, eventually two more of the horsemen die and more quote unquote plagues come. One of them, which is aeroplanes falling from the sky, which I found quite eerie. There was also one of them, they say, like when they show it on the TV, the BBC News says like pre-recorded footage. And I was like, they are kind of like lying about it. But slowly what happens is when eventually Dave Bautista's character, Leonard, he goes, right, this is your last chance. And they go, nope, we're not going to do it. He then kills himself. And then
the apocalypse kind of does start to happen, and they're like, shit, okay, he was right all along. And then they make a decision to sacrifice one of them. And then it kind of, then they end up saving it, like, well, eventually. And I found it, I don't know, I just really like the concept. I liked the script, the kind of reasoning that they give. I also thought like the fact that, for the most part, like, the Four Horsemen, as they dub themselves, but also not presented as just like crazy. So you're kind of thinking, oh, well, these people clearly believe what they're saying. And Dave Bautista's performance is quite restrained, which is different from his usual roles. But I think he gave a good performance. You kind of think, because he gives it a lot of empathy as well. And you're like, well, he clearly believes something. And that created a lot of tension for me. And also they kind of, Eric and Andrew are sort of saying, well, you just targeted us because we're a same-sex couple. And you kind of think, okay, I felt like right up until towards the end, I didn't actually know what outcome was going to be. So I quite liked it, but I think I'm more hot on it than you are, OB.
Yeah, I thought it was fine. I didn't love it. Didn't hate it. I think I've kind of fell into this trap of thinking that it was going to be some big twist at the end. So when it comes out to the end and they say, oh, actually, yeah, they did save the world. I was going to be like, oh, all right, sure, I guess. I think I was more interested as it went along. Because I think when it started, I was a bit like, I didn't really care about anything that was going on. But kind of like as it progressed, I think Dave Bautista kind of grew into the film quite a lot as well. I thought that was really good. And like you say, the two husbands, one of whom was used to be on Glee, Jesse St. James, and the little girl, I think they were like, I liked their chemistry as a family. And even like when it was flashing back to kind of like them meeting each other, them meeting the parents, them in the bar and stuff like that. I thought that was nice to give us, to let us kind of like grow with these characters and get a bit more background to them kind of thing. And at the end, when one of them sacrificed himself, I was like, oh, that's quite sad kind of thing. And like, part of me was kind of happy that I guess that sacrifice meant something. But yeah. Again, I was kind of like, oh, I kind of wish that like, you know, they went and the world was still like burning to hell or something. They're like, and one thing that I thought was that I didn't enjoy that much was that the fact that when they're kind of like, there wasn't to me that much ambiguity as to whether or not they were telling the truth. To me, it was, I just was, when they were showing like all like these tsunamis and stuff like that, I was like, okay, so they're telling the truth then. So then I was kind of like, there was no part of me wondering whether or not it was bullshit, because I kind of like believed it as soon as they kind of showed that first clip.
See, for me, yeah. It wasn't until the plane started falling out the sky, I was like, oh, okay. This is... Because there was that thing on the BBC News about old pre-recorded footage, and I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
You know, there was that doubt in me. Yeah. I also think, like, I was thinking, what would I do in this situation? And I was like, you know what, I'm selfish enough to probably just let the world burn.
Well, the thing, when Andrew was like, let the world burn then, I was like, yeah, if it was me... Work and fucking burn.
Yeah.
I thought it was like, an okay film. It was better than Old, which was the last M. Night Shyamalan film.
Yeah. Yeah. He self-funds all the film, all his recent films as well.
Okay, that's good on him. I hope he makes money then, in that case.
Yeah, yeah. This film has pretty much done similar numbers to Plane. So that, I guess, brings us to the end. We are going to talk about The Last of Us, probably once it's finished, considering there's not too many episodes left. By next pod, I probably would have watched Tar. I'm also planning on seeing Pearl, which is the prequel to a film called X, which came out last year. And I'm not really sure what else is coming out.
I'm not sure. Creed 3 comes out in like 2 weeks. I'm really looking forward to that.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, that's what I can think of it.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you for tuning in. You can find previous episodes on Spotify or Apple, where we are Your Average Critics. We're also on Instagram as Your Average Critics and Twitter as YSC Podcast 17.
Keep it sexy.